Okay, it is now just such an honor, you guys, and a privilege for me to introduce you, your speaker today. You know, it just shows that if we keep an open heart and an open mind, God will bring us the exact people that we need on this journey right in front of us at the right time. I will tell you what I do know about this woman in the short time that I've gotten to know her. She does not co-sign my BS, like, at all. So she is a testament, man, to this program, to the God of my understanding, and to just living this deal. I also think it's important to note that when you travel out of state to these things with a sponsee, you're doing this thing, right? And I was, you know, so grateful that she brought Lynn with her, and this has been an amazing experience for me. So I'm going to let her talk, which is shocking. So thank you. Amanda V.
Hey, Fanny, my name is Amanda Brown. I'm a happy alcoholic. Amen. By the grace of God, I'm sober today. It is so good to see all of you on this Sunday morning. You know, on the Sunday morning, we never really know what we're going to get. People got to fly out. They got to drive home. And so usually the Sunday morning is a smaller crowd, but this is a wonderful crowd. Thank you so much for being here this morning. Y'all are absolutely beautiful on this Sunday morning. My sobriety date is May 19th, 1991. My home group is the Legacies Group in Montgomery, Alabama. It's right in the middle of the state. All you got to do is go down to Atlanta and turn on 85, and you'll run right smack dab into Montgomery. As a matter of fact, one of those exits is less than a mile from my house. So literally, come on. Legacies Group, we have a meeting at 6 o'clock on Monday night, meeting at 8 o'clock on Wednesday night. That's our speaker meeting. We've got a meeting at 8 o'clock on Friday night. That's our candlelight meeting. We have a meeting every day during the week at noon, and we have a 9 a.m. Sunday morning meeting. So if you're ever over there, just come on. I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you. Don, thank you so much, you and the committee, for asking me to speak. It was kind of a trial and error getting me here, but I was so glad that the God of my experience worked that out and that I was able to be with all of you this weekend. I've had an absolutely wonderful weekend. If you served on the committee or did registration or did raffle or any service in any capacity, would you please stand up so that we can thank you? Yes, come on. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I know that it takes a village to put one of these things on. And, you know, people get to come and they get to enjoy and they don't really get to see all the behind the scenes. And it is an ordeal. It is a commitment. It is a sacrifice. And then we get the blessing getting to see all the people come and the lives that are changed. So thank you, thank you, thank you so much for being willing to be of service. I wanted to say thanks to Jim for Friday night. What a fabulous way to open up the weekend. I had the honor of speaking with him a few years ago in Atlanta. Just an amazing man, an amazing story. If you weren't here, please get the CD. One of my favorite things he talked about was that he didn't take a drink in kindergarten, but he sure could have used one. And then now he doesn't like to do harm to anything, and he told a story about holding a bee in his hand and letting it fly out there. Well, I have to confess, I killed a spider in the hallway yesterday. Some things I cannot harm, but if you're creepy crawly, you're dead. I'm just, you know. God forgive me on that one. Hella, our Al-Anon speaker yesterday, wow, what a powerful story. Look, I have mad respect for the Al-Anons. If it was not for my mother, the Al-Anon in my life, I would not be here today. And what you may not realize, if it was not for Lois and Al-Anon, we may not be here today. So I always want to thank the Al-Anons for being here, for your support and your encouragement. Hella talked a lot yesterday about courage. She absolutely had a lot of courage to stand up and share her story with her yesterday. And I hope that one day I can have an entourage like she does. I want to thank Robbie for letting me be a part of the Robbie Walker Show this weekend. I mean, I've had a good time. How can you not have a good time around Robbie Walker? I mean, come on. That was just absolutely amazing. His big boot camp yesterday, oh my God, and then his story last night. So thank you, thank you, thank you for coming all the way from Jersey. Come down here and share your story with us. And I want to give a special shout out to my hostess with the mostest, Toby. The theme of the conference this weekend is the And Share Love, and she absolutely has shared the love with me. God bless her. You know, my sponsor raised me to understand, and it proves true even today, that I can tell by how good a weekend is going to be by how insane the week before it is, right? The more crazy stuff happens the week before, the better that weekend's going to be, because the enemy does not want me to have a good weekend, so it's going to throw everything it can at me to try to mess up me and my program and my serenity so that I won't enjoy that weekend. So God bless her. She has been trying to call me for at least 2 months. And so we finally did start texting Thursday. And she has absolutely been a blessing in my life. She has absolutely shared the love with me this weekend. And then my sponsee was here, and she was gracious enough to let her be a part of our little group. And, you know, when we travel, we never really know what we're going to get. So I'm always really grateful and pleasantly surprised when I get somebody good that we have that connection with, and then God begins to show me why that person was placed in my life. I don't know that she was really ready for that 30 minutes in, but I can't help it. I'm a truth teller, and it just comes out, you know. Just say it. So thank you, thank you, thank you. I used to be the grateful alcoholic because my sponsor taught me early on that gratitude had to be a part of my life. Well, a few years ago, my sponsor died, and she was the happy alcoholic. And her sponsor before her was the happy alcoholic. And that had been passed down in my lineage, so she made me promise that when she passed away that I would be the happy alcoholic. So I'm absolutely happy, joyous, and free today, but I'm still grateful. And so when I come to this on this Sunday morning, I have to stop and I have to be grateful. You know, so many of y'all this weekend have come up to me and said, "Ooh, Sunday morning spiritual speaker, ooh, I can't wait to hear what you're going to say." I'm like, me too. I never know what God's going to do. You know, after 28 years of sobriety, I got sober when I was 19. That's a lot of life experiences. I have known loss. I have known death. I've outlived two of my sponsors and a mentor. I've had at least 3 periods in my sobriety where I thought about taking a drink. I have no idea what's going to come out of my mouth in this next hour. All I can do is pee and pray. Talked to both my sponsors this morning. They prayed over me. We talked about some things. And I'm just here to be a vessel for the God of my experience. And we're just going to see what happens. So I know, you know, sometimes we have these expectations of the spiritual Sunday morning speaker, but please, I want you to know from the bottom of my heart, please don't put me on a pedestal. I'm human. I'm just a no-good drunk woman that God gave the gift of gab to, and I was on the stage all my life, and I got no problems being up here. And just to be a vessel for Him, to be a vessel for that power, that it would bring out it. That power greater than me knows who is in this audience. The power greater than me knows what needs to come out of my mouth to touch whoever it needs to touch. And I'm just to stand here and be a vessel for Him. So I always try to stop and be grateful. I'm so grateful that we have this beautiful building to have a conference in this morning. I am so grateful that I'm standing before you today and I have brushed my teeth. I'm standing before you today and I've got a skirt on. I've got on clean clothes. I had the opportunity to put on deodorant this morning, and I made the choice to put on the deodorant this morning. I'm wearing underwear before you today. That wasn't necessarily a necessity. Not only am I wearing underwear, I'm wearing a girdle because my meemaw taught me that. I got a girdle on. I got to sleep last night in a big old bed with clean sheets. Woke up this morning, I didn't have to guess who I was laying next to. I got to use a bathroom. I got to go in there and use a clean toilet. I didn't have to squat in a parking lot or defecate or urinate wherever I might come to. There's nothing in that fridge upstairs except Starbucks in a can and bottles of water. I've got money in my purse that I didn't have to steal. I've got a debit card in there with my name on it. I know where my children are today. I know where my husband is. I'm so grateful for Bill and Bob. I'm so grateful for Ann Smith and Henrietta Siberling. And people you may not really understand, like a man by the name of James Newton. And if it was not for him, we would not be here today. All of that first 100. I'm thankful for the Washingtonians and the Oxford group who helped develop this program for Bill and Bob. I'm so grateful for printing presses so that we could print the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could go on and on and on, but I have to stop and think about that. I'm so grateful that the sunrise came up this morning and I was at the window to see it. And that I can appreciate that today. I'm so grateful for my life today, that I'm above ground, that I'm not behind bars this morning. Because that has been a privilege denied to many. Now, I'm supposed to share with you what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like today. But I believe Spirit has a little different thing going on with me today. So the first thing I got to tell you is I got to tell you where I'm at. I got to tell you where I'm at on this Sunday morning. I am coming out of a spiritual desert, for lack of any other way to put it. And for the Al-Anons in the room, I'm good. I've got my tissue. It has been an interesting few months in my family. One thing that happened was my husband is civilian, but he works for the military and he works on the Air Force base there in Montgomery. And one of the places that they are making the biggest budget cuts is with cybersecurity, which is what my husband does. So right around the 1st of July, the contractor that won that bid so low that everybody's leaving like rats on a sinking ship. So he had a job, but the pay was significantly decreased, and we had no insurance. We have not had insurance since July 4th. So this has been an interesting time in my sobriety because it's the first time I have really felt some fear about finances. Now, I was a stay-at-home mom most of my children's life, and I, a few years ago, went back as a substitute teacher because of the flexibility, and that way I can still be a part of my children's lives. So it has been interesting to watch myself and my program and my family, and how are we dealing with this time in our lives. On top of that, my daughter is a senior in high school. And I didn't really realize what was going on with me until Hella said something yesterday. And I had to go back to my room and I had to call my sponsors. I don't know how to really describe what has been going on with me with her being a senior. And one of my mommy friends said, "Man, no, you know, you can't pre-mourn. You can't be sad her whole senior year." I'm like, "I know, but I've got all these emotions and I have felt crazy. I have felt crazy for at least about 3 weeks." And my sponsor said, "Amanda, you're not crazy. You're out of your routine. I mean, my meeting schedule is off. My talking to my sponsees is off. There have been days where I have not wanted to answer the phone, and I did not answer the phone. There have been days when during the week when I have been in my pajamas when my kids went to school and I was in the same pajamas when they came home. I have been off my game." I didn't really understand. I don't even know what Hella said yesterday. But I had a realization yesterday. Meaning what affected which part got me, you know. I know what she said, but I was here. But something she said made me aware. And what I know today is awareness is 95% of any problem that I have in my life today. Anytime I am disturbed, if I can be aware of what it is that is affecting me, then I begin to have choices. I can accept it or not. I can do something about it or not. So what happened yesterday was I am extremely aware that I don't want the things that happened to me when I went to college to happen to her. And that I went through something like this when my children were 8. And that I went through something like this when my children were 12. Because those were significant years in my life. And it has nothing to do with her. She is fierce. And she is strong. And she is smart as a whip. And she's going to be okay. This is my stuff. But I didn't have that till yesterday. So I'm a little of a clump this morning. I'm 2 out of 4. I'm tired and I'm emotional. Out of hungry, angry, lonely, tired. I'm 2 out of 4. Now, if I was at home, I would be in my bedroom with the door closed, talking on the phone to my sponsor. But this morning, God's got me 2 out of 4 in front of a room full of strangers. So here we go. So I needed to share that with you. You know? Now, what am I going to do about it? I'm going to keep putting her in the third step prayer every day. I know that God has got her. I know that He has got her in the palm of His hand. You know, Dr. Paulo, he's the one that wrote page 449 and where it talks about nothing happens in God's world by mistake. But in later interviews, one of the things he talks about that he wished he could have had more room to talk about, but we're not in God's world. Okay? We're in the fallen world. We haven't got to God's world yet. So bad things are going to happen. I do not believe that God, today I do not believe, that God strikes things down and God makes bad things happen. What I know in my life and my experience is the enemy is alive and well and it wants to mess me up. It wants to mess up my serenity. It does not want me to be a vessel for God. It does not want God to be able to use me to help somebody else get sober. And it will do anything in its power to make that not happen. So it thinks that it's trying to trip me up. But what I know this morning is God is bigger. The God of my experience is bigger. And the battle's already been won. So I believe some of what I'm supposed to share this morning is what did my spirituality look like and what happened and what does my spirituality look like today? I will tell you I grew up in a small town in Andalusia, Alabama. I was an only child, the oldest grandchild, and the oldest great-grandchild, and to say that I was selfish and self-centered is an understatement. My world did revolve around me. Everything revolved around me. Jim talked about kindergarten. I got my first resentment in kindergarten. We're out there playing on the playground, and the kids are talking about what their parents do, and I would just tell people, I don't have a daddy. Asking about what their mom and their daddy do. Well, I just don't have a daddy. I don't have a daddy. That was easier to say than, my mama married a drunk and alcoholic biker who used to beat her to death, and the day that he took the shotgun to her when she was 6 months pregnant with me and threatened to kill her, she called her daddy to come rescue her from Mississippi, and that's how we wound up in Andalusia. Ain't no five-year-old got time for all that. It was just easier to say I didn't have a daddy. Two things happened when I was 8 years old. When I was 8 years old, I got diagnosed with my hearing loss. I'm hard of hearing. I wear hearing aids. I'm a lip reader. I've been a lip reader all my life. Well, what they used to do is they would come around and they would take you to the library, the whole class, and they'd put the little headphones on you and you'd raise your hand when you hear the beeps. Well, I never raised my hand. So what that looked like in my life was that put me on the special ed list for the rest of my life. I had to go to a speech therapist at school twice a week to learn how to say my W's and my R's, which I still, when I start talking fast, water may sound like water. All through high school. And so I had to sit in the front of the classroom. I never got to pick the seat by my best friend. I had to be in the seat in front of the teacher so that I could read their lips. Okay. The second thing that happened when I was 8 years old is my mama left me. Now, it took me a long time in sobriety to be able to say that statement. My mama left me. What that looked like was, my mother was a single mother. My grandparents helped raise me. I was raised with both sets of grandparents, both sets of great-grandparents in the middle of the woods, aunt and uncle on the other side. I'm a country girl, pond, fishing, farming, all that, right? My family was there. But my mother decided that she wanted to better herself and go to college 4 hours north of me in Birmingham. So she comes to me one day after school, and she sits me down, and she says, Amanda, I'm going to go to college in Birmingham at UAB. Do you want to live with me in Birmingham, or do you want to stay here with me, Mom and Peepaw? Now, I will tell you, by this age in my life, Mama had already been divorced a couple of times, and I never knew what that life was going to look like with her. We lived in one shack where I remember the orange 70s shag carpet, and literally was a tin roof shack. And one of the places we lived in, I would lay down in my bed at night, and it was in front of a window, and I could hear the tree roaches crawling over my head and across the windowsill. One house, we would, like, she would be ready with the door and the key in the door, and we would be ready because we would have to run in the room and jump on the furniture for her to flick on the lights for the rats to run. So I didn't know what life was going to look like living with my mama. And so at 8 years old, she had asked me to make a decision. Do I want to live with her? Or do I want to stay in Andalusia with all my family and my cousins and my grandparents? And I chose to stay in Andalusia, and my mother was gone for the next 4 years. Now, I'm going to skip ahead. During that time from 8 to 12, I began to develop what I call my survival instincts. My sponsor later called her my character defects. But I'm going to skip ahead to the age of 12. I heard a speaker say one time, if we could keep children from turning 12 and being raised in Southern Baptist churches, we'd have a lot fewer alcoholics. And that was certainly the truth in my case. I had been raised in that Southern Baptist church. All I knew of God was my big mama, who was Church of Christ. And I remember going to her church and singing in shape notes. And she was the embodiment of what spirituality looked like to me. She was the embodiment of what Christianity at that time looked like to me. That's all I knew. My house was not raised saying prayers. I mean, we said the blessing over the food every night, but that was about it. My peepaw was a retired lieutenant colonel in the Army. My meemaw was an officer's wife. We had two preachers in the family, but they belonged to the family across the street. I didn't really see them a whole lot. So I didn't really have any idea of spirituality or having a relationship with the Creator. So, 12 years old, three things happened. First thing was the day I learned how to lie. Now, I had been raised not to lie, to always tell the truth. I had never lied to my mother. But this particular, and I was a very active child. I was in the band. I was in every single choral ensemble I could be in. I was dancing four or five nights a week. I was always on the go. Looking back, what I know is I was getting away from the environment that I had been placed in. So it was normal in any afternoon for Meemaw to pick me up, me change clothes in the car, and go to wherever the next place I was going. Well, on this particular afternoon, obviously we had gotten our signals crossed. So for 2.5 hours, I didn't know where Meemaw was, and she didn't know where I was. Now, back in them days, you didn't dare call DHR. We didn't even have 911. We didn't do no child protective services. When you got in trouble, you got your butt beat. Now, what that looked like in our house was, when you got in trouble, you had to go out and pick a switch. And if it didn't have enough to it, Meemaw would have to pick it, and God help you if Meemaw had to pick the switch, right? So I knew after 2.5 hours, this was not going to be pretty. So Meemaw did find me. Sure enough, I went home, and she beat me. She beat me the worst she'd ever beat me. She beat me so bad that day I had blood literally running down my legs. I called my mother. My mother drove the four hours south to Andalusia, sat at the kitchen table and told my Meemaw, "You will never lay another hand on my child as long as you live." Now, I will tell you, Meemaw never laid another hand on me as long as she lived. But there were many days I wish she would, because the scorn and withholding love from a child is so much worse. I just wanted her to beat me. The second thing that happened that year, I loved fishing with my peepaw. Oh, my God, I love being out there on the pond with him. It didn't rain, if it was sunning or shining, raining, whatever, I'm out there with him. Loved it. Well, one day we're out there fishing, and somehow we got on the subject of him and Meemaw arguing. Now, I did not like it when Meemaw and Peepaw argued. I had seen my mother do that, and I knew that that would be awful, right? And so when I would find them arguing in the middle of the night, it would put fear in me. So, you know, I'm talking to Peepaw one day, and we're talking about them arguing, and I said, "Well, why don't you just get a divorce? Mama does it all the time." I mean, I'm 12 years old. I didn't think anything about it, right? So one day I come home from school, and I don't know about y'all and the environment y'all grew up in, but in the environment I grew up in, I could walk into a room and know that something was wrong. You could just feel it. It's like thick. I'm like, ooh. So I go in the kitchen, and Meemaw is sitting in her place, and her face is red, her nose is red, and she has been crying. Meemaw never cried. Peepaw's at the head of the table, and his face is red, his nose is red, and he had been crying. And I had never seen him cry, not even at his father's funeral. So I knew something bad was going on. So Peepaw said, "Amanda, come here." And he patted his lap, my favorite place. So I go over and I sit on Peepaw's lap, and he says, "Amanda, do you remember us talking that day fishing about me and Meemaw arguing?" And I said, "Well, yes, sir." And he said, "Well, do you remember what you said?" And I said, "Well, yes, sir. I said, why don't you get a divorce?" And my peepaw said, "Well, we are." So immediately in my 12-year-old mind, it's all my fault. It's all my fault. "Amanda, why did you say that? Oh, my God, you said that, and now Meemaw and Peepaw are getting divorced. Oh, my God, what's going to happen? What's going to happen to me? This is my safe place. This is my home. Amanda, look what you've done. Oh, my God." Could not believe it. Now, the reality of that situation was Peepaw had fallen in love with my Meemaw's married best friend, who divorced her husband, married my Peepaw, and they built a house over the pond that my Meemaw could see out the kitchen window the rest of her life. Yeah, full disclosure, it took me about 18 years to forgive that woman. Just saying. Anyway, so that was the second thing that happened. third thing, that, I mean, I know everybody had a part to play, but that was the hardest one for me. Okay. Third thing that happened that year, my mother had always told me that I could find my real father when I was 12 years old. I had one picture of them. It was them on their wedding day. There's her in that beautiful white dress that belonged to my cousin. And here's this 6'5" skinny guy. They called him Slim. He had a military haircut, one blue eye, one green eye. And he was a good looking man, you know. Well, you know, this has not been a banner year for me already. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe I do want to find my father. Maybe I want to know what he's like. And maybe he's rich and can take me somewhere exotic like California. You know, you know, let's see what the other half lives. Yes, Mama, let's find my daddy. So Mama starts making phone calls. Lo and behold, he's living in his mother's basement. That should have been clue number one right there. So we traipse off to Spring Hill, Tennessee, which is where they lived, and we get there, and I meet my grandma, and I meet my grandpa, and we're sitting in the front room talking, and I hear a noise I had never heard before. Holly, 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 coming up the driveway. And the best way I know how to describe it is there is a woolly booger sitting on a motorcycle. Now, I had never, come on, y'all know what a woolly booger is? Think Bigfoot, all hairy and big and... In that small town I was in, everybody looked like us, talked like us. We all went to the American Legion on Friday night, played bingo. You either went to the Baptist church or the Methodist church because Catholic was foreign. I mean, you know, just, you know. I had never seen anything like this before in my life. So it pulls up in front of the house and it parks the motorcycle and it gets off and it's got a beard down to its belly. It's got hair down to its butt. It is covered in tattoos. This one says F off. I had never even heard that, let alone seen it in ink on somebody's body. And it comes in the front room and it says, well, aren't you going to hug your old man? I said, no. That was the other half of me. The grass wasn't greener. He wasn't taking me nowhere, and I needed a drink. It wasn't but a few months after that I did take my first conscious drink of alcohol. And I say conscious drink because I had drank before. My granddaddy, my great-granddaddy, but we called him granddaddy, made the best couple of wine on God's green earth. And every holiday... They used to have these little glasses in the detergent boxes, little depression glasses. They were green, about that tall, right? So every holiday, us kids would get a glass full. Oh, that stuff was so good. And I can remember giving my glass back to Mama saying, please, can I have some more, right? But I was about to take my first conscious drink of alcohol. My guy best friend, Tim, his daddy owned a cabin down in Panama City Beach, which is not far from where I live. And we all go down there, and his daddy starts going around and taking drink orders. So my best friend, Tim, orders a 6-pack of peach wine coolers. I said, well, that sounds good. I'll try that. Daddy goes away, comes back. We've all got our stuff. I drank every one of that 6-pack of peach wine coolers and proceeded to have the best night's sleep of my little life. Alcohol immediately did for me what I could not do for myself. I blacked out that night, and I will tell you I was a blackout drinker from the get-go. Now, I don't know if I became alcoholic in that moment, but I will tell you every opportunity after that, I was hunting it, trying to get it, trying to get it, trying to find it, trying to steal it. I wanted more of that because I was able to go to sleep. It shut up all the voices in my head. You know, I remember as a child just laying in the bed at night and just all the voices in my head and all the worries and who's Mama married to now and who's going to she divorce now and what's going to happen to me and what's going to happen to me, Mom, people, and look what you did to their lives. I mean, just all of that, all of that, all of that. And when I drank that entire 6-pack and had the best night's sleep of my little life, I wanted more. I wanted more of that. High school rocked on. My disease began to progress. You know, it talks about in the big book that many of us are gone beyond recall in a few years. This is especially true of women. Had my first drink when I was 12 years old. My disease in high school progressed, field parties, band parties. There was a Hardee's on one end and a McDonald's on one end. Any weekend, we were over here and we'd mix drinks in the Hardee's parking lot and we'd come through town and we'd go by the Dairy Queen and we'd drive around the square and go in front of the courthouse and we'd go on down and we'd get in front of McDonald's. Well, by then I'm empty. It's time to remake another drink. My disease progressed. I started stealing liquor from me and my mom. I'm a Bacardi 151 girl. That was my drink of choice. I would get a Sprite bottle, and I would pour out all the Sprite, and I would fill that bad boy up with me and mom's Bacardi 151, and we all sitting down at the dinner table, and they think I'm drinking a Sprite, and I'm already tying one on. You know. Now, my mama had gotten just a smidge of Al-Anon somewhere in there, because at one point she wanted to talk about an intervention, and she had started measuring how much liquor Mima was drinking on a daily basis. Yeah, she didn't know. She thought Mima was drinking a whole lot more than what she was drinking, right? And it became a pattern for me. I went to the University of Alabama. I joined the Million Dollar Band. I had 415 brand new best friends. Thursday night was the Green Book party after band practice. Friday night was the party before the game. Saturday, I'm either celebrating or commiserating. Either way, I'm getting drunk. Sunday was some pro football party somewhere, and my disease began to progress. February 19th, 1991 was an important day for me because that's the day that my big mama died. See, she was the epitome of spirituality. She was the epitome of that unconditional love for me. You know, I felt when I disappointed my grandfather. My mother and mine's relationship was rocky, and Mima, although I loved her, she had her own issues, you know. And so Big Mama was that all-encompassing bundle of love for me. If anything bad happened to me, she would just tell me it would be okay, and she'd make me a whole thing of baked macaroni and cheese with sausage in it like I like it, you know? So when she died, I was drunk that morning. I was drunk, and my girlfriend Michelle was there, and the family called me. I don't even know who called me. And I remember asking Michelle to drive me to Andalusia, because Tuscaloosa is at the top of the state. Andalusia is literally at the bottom of the state. It's like 4.5 hours. I said, will you drive me? And she said, yes. And so she was driving me down to my big mama's funeral. And I said, you know, I can still see Brother Foster up there at that pulpit, slamming that Bible down on that pulpit, telling me I'm going to hell. That every thought that I had that was a sin was just as bad as doing the sin. And you're going to hell. I said, let me see how fast I can get there. Because I knew the things that I was doing in my life. I knew there were things in my life that I was doing was wrong. I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know how to stop it. And as a woman, alcoholic, I don't have to go into details on this Sunday morning. I will tell you that a lot of my energy was spent on how am I going to get it? What have I got to do to get it? Where's my next drink coming from? And I did on a daily basis what I had to do to get that alcohol that I had to have to survive. The next 100 and so days are a blur to me. I lived most of my alcoholic life, drinking life, in blackout. I have about 4 memories. I believe the God of my experience has allowed me to keep those memories to help me remember what it was like in those last days. Okay, I'll share those with you. One memory is I wake up in this concrete stairwell. I have no idea where I am. My head is in one of those big square black industrial trash cans, and I am covered in puke, pee, vomit, feces, blood. Anything that you can think of is on me. One morning I come to, and I'm in a bedroom, and I don't know who that is. And I'm checking all the empties. I'm seeing what's around me that's got anything left in it. And I go in the bathroom cabinet, and I'm looking for Listerine, alcohol, NyQuil, cough syrup. Is there anything in this cabinet that I can get some alcohol in me? And then I'm going in the kitchen, and I'm praying the real vanilla extract is in there and not that imitation mess. Third memory is I'm coming to, and there's a lot of noise, and there's lights, and there's honking, and it's so loud, and somebody's dragging me, and my back hurts, and it's getting all scratched, and she's dragging me, and what I found out later was McFarland Avenue is the busiest street in Tuscaloosa, and I have laid down in front of oncoming traffic, and they are trying to get me out of the oncoming traffic. The last memory I have, we're at a bar. I don't think it's there anymore. It used to be called the Ivory Tusk. And, you know, the disease had progressed. I've done everything where it said, here are the methods we tried, and taking money for one beer, and then there's this cute guy next to me, and I've got my drinks bought the rest of the night, and trying to switch from liquor to beer, and beer got me drunk faster. And I did all of those things that the book talks about. And so I'm at this college bar, and I've got a Miller Lite long neck in one hand and a cigarette in the other hand, and there's a band playing, and we're all standing there, and we're doing the college dance, right? And I proceed to crap all in my pants. And I take a swig, and I take a puff. Rock on. That's where alcohol took me. That's where alcohol took me. God, Bobby talked about pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. I had no morals at that point. I had no God of any kind at that point. And I just wanted to die. I just wanted to die. And I was trying to drink enough to kill myself. So what happened was the grace of God. God started giving my mother nightmares. And she showed up in Tuscaloosa on May 18th, 1991. She said, I don't know what's going on with you, but I'm here to offer you some help. Or we can go have lunch and I'll go home. So she gave me 2 hours to think about it. She came with the two best friends. Mama and one best friend leaves. The other best friend stays with me. And I told her, you know, part of my other disease was when I would want to feel better, I would want to go shopping. And so it never occurred to me that just because there are checks still left in the checkbook, that there might not be money in that account. As long as I got checks, I'm writing them, right? So all these brown official-looking documents that say federal government on the envelope started showing up in my mailboxes. Well, I just wouldn't touch them because if I don't touch it, it ain't real, right? Alcoholic thinking. So I just ignored all that. So on this day, I told her best friend, you know, I might have written a few bad checks. So she calls a lawyer friend of hers, and I could tell from the tone of the conversation this was not going to bode well for me. So by the time Mama got back, I said, you know what, Mama, I want some help. So that day, we left Tuscaloosa, went to Andalusia, got a couple hours sleep. May 19th, 1991, I'm in Mobile, Alabama, at the bottom of the state, on the 10th floor of Providence Hospital in the psych ward. And I will never forget the sound of those doors closing behind me. Now, I will tell you, in my sobriety, I have usually been the youngest one. When I entered treatment that day, I was 19. I was in that treatment center for 60 days. I turned 20 while I was in treatment, and I remember that day because that's the day I got to level 4 and got to come down off the 10th floor, and we went to Shoney's, and I had strawberry shortcake. And I remember that. That was my 20th birthday. And I made the mistake of telling my psychiatrist one day I might have drank a little bit. Unbeknownst to me, he was a recovering alcoholic. So he started sending my young butt to those AA meetings, and I didn't want to be around all y'all. Y'all were old and crusty. Honestly, y'all probably were the same age I am right now, but we're just not going to go there. Right? So they started sending me, and they started sending me, and I didn't want what you had, and I didn't want you hugging me, and I didn't want you shaking my hand, and just leave me alone, please. And I would sit in the back of the room, and I'd have my knees around me, and I was hiding behind my hair. And then one day they took us to a speaker meeting at the Alano Club down there in Mobile. So this young woman got up there. She was blonde. She was young. And she was telling me the things that she used to do. And now she drank like me. But she's standing there. She's clean. She's brushed her teeth. She's wearing clothes. She's probably got underwear on. You know, she's smiling. She's got all her teeth. Her hair look. I mean, all that. All of that. And she's saying that she's an alcoholic. Well, maybe that's what's wrong with me. She drank like I did. She used her body like I did. But she's saying she's an alcoholic and that she's been able to do something different. Maybe that's what's wrong with me. And for the first time, I had hope. And that day, my ears opened up. That day, I began to listen to the similarities and not the differences because it was so, you know, coming in here, and I believe it happens to a lot of us. I'm not like you. I'm not like you. I didn't do that. I didn't do that. I didn't sleep under a bridge. Technicality. You know, I didn't drink in the morning. Technicality. I didn't wake up till afternoon. You know, all of that. All those differences. And when I began to open up my ears and hear the similarities, we are so much alike. You may not have the same childhood that I did, but when I talk about how different I felt and the pain that I felt and the aloneness that I felt, you get that. You know exactly what I'm talking about when I talk about that. I got out of treatment after 60 days. I did not know where I was going. My mother had rounded up all those official-looking documents. It was two big paper sack, grocery sack full. And the least amount of time I was looking at was 15 years in Junior Tutwiler Prison, which is 20 minutes up the road from where I live now. So when I was coming down the elevator, I remember my counselor asking me, she said, Amanda, she said, you're so young, do you really think you can go the rest of your life without taking another drink of alcohol? I said, Jeannie, they tell me I don't have to think like that. All I got to do is not drink today. And I can do that today. Walked out of the elevator, my mother is standing there with a contract. That contract said a lot, but the gist of it was she was going to let me go live with her. With all these stipulations, she had paid all that money back, and I had 10 years to pay that back, or I'd have to finish my time. by the grace of God, because of a car accident, because God using a car accident, I was able to pay that money off at 8 years sober. I had been working. I had 3 jobs in 2 counties and no car. I was doing everything I was supposed to do. And right around that time, I only had a certain amount of money left. And I was like, and I had been praying, like, God, how am I going to, I don't want to go to prison. How am I going to pay this off? How am I going to pay this off? Well, we had an accident while I was in area assembly. It was not my fault. It was the company, the guy driving the company truck's fault. And what happened was the lawyer called me in there one day, and he said, they've settled your case. And I kid you not, the amount on that check was the exact amount to the penny that I left owed my mama. See, that's how God will work in my life if I continue to do the footwork. So I go to Level Plains. Level Plains was my first home group outside of Dothan, Alabama. It's about 45 minutes up the road. There's a caution light, and you turn right, and there's a bar, and there's a clubhouse. And it's called the Wiregrass Club in Level Plains. And I walked in that night, and everybody had a seat, and I could still see everybody where they were sitting. And my sponsor was right here. My grand sponsor was right there. And Miss Peggy patted that little seat. She said, here, honey, come sit by me. And I know they were my sponsor and my grand sponsor because they told me. I didn't ask. I will tell you, I was the youngest one in that group. Most of my sobriety, I have been the youngest one. Most of my sobriety, I have been one or two females. I will tell you where I live today, I'm one of 3 women with over 25 years sobriety. That's been hard. That's been hard. That's been interesting, but God has got me through it all. So Miss Gloria that night, my sponsor, she told me, she said, Amanda, I want to tell you something. She said, you never have to take another drink of alcohol ever again if you don't want to. And we can help you with that. So that was some real important words that I needed to hear that night. The next night, she took me through the doctor's opinion. We started going through the book, and she took me to the doctor's opinion where she explained to me about the disease and the allergy and the spiritual malady and that I'm not just a bad person. There's a reason why I do the things that I do. You know, and the debate about are you born with it or not, look, I don't know. I know that I drank enough to I cross that line, but I also know that there's not a leaf, limb, or fork in my family tree that don't have a drunk, addict, or gambler on it. So either way, I was coming by it honestly. And my great-grandparents was an Irishman fresh off the boat who married the daughter of an Indian chief. So I'm getting it. I mean, you know. So I began to live this way of life. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. Gloria and Peggy and the gentleman in that group literally raised me up. Raise me up in this program. Excuse me. Literally, my sponsor would tell me what to do every morning when I got up. She would tell me what to wear. There was many a night I would come to the clubhouse thinking that I was looking cute, and she would tell me, oh, no, ma'am, go home and try again. Because I was feeling my hoochie mama role, right? I mean, you know. So she had to teach me all of that. She said, Amanda, do you want to be the reason that you distract that young man beside you and he does not hear what he needs to hear that's going to save his life? And I said, well, no, ma'am. She's like, go home and try again. Literally, they raised me up in this program. I grew up going to conferences, areas, assemblies, roundups. We would all just load up in a car, and they'd be 15 of us in somebody's room. I mean, that's just how I was raised up in this program, and I began to see happy, joyous, and free. But this is also when I began to develop a relationship with a creator. My sponsor, you know, I was really angry at God for a lot of years. And after Big Mama died, I was done. I was done. I wanted no part of any of that. And she's like, well, Amanda, do you believe that I believe? Yes, I believe that you believe. She's like, well, can you pray to my God for a while until you get your own? I said, absolutely. So I started out praying to Gloria's God. And I had to say the serenity prayer, and I had to say the third step prayer, and I had to thank him in the morning, and I had to thank him in the night. You know, and then we got to the second step. And in the second step, she had me do an exercise. She got a big yellow legal pad, and I had to draw a line down the middle of the pad. She said, okay, on this left side, I want you to write down all your ideas about God today. Zeus, lightning bolt, vengeful, angry, mad, unforgiving, a lot of harsh words, right? She said, okay, on the right side, I want you to write down some things that you would like the God of your experience to be. Santa Claus. I'm a visual person. Santa Claus. happy, jolly, caring, forgiving, generous, all those kind of words on that right side, right? So she said, okay, so we took a pair of scissors and we cut that paper down the middle. And she had me rip up and shred and burn up that left side, my old ideas. And we released that. That smoke going up, I released that. She said, okay, I want you to take that right side list and hang it on your bathroom mirror, and that's the God that I want you to start praying to. And I will tell you that served me well for many years. Now, I keep working this program, so my God, the God of my experience, looks very different today. He doesn't necessarily have to look like Santa Claus. But that was my journey. That was how I started. She taught me to use that third-step prayer, use that seven-step prayer, use that 11-step prayer. And I want to say, that sheet a while ago said the promises. Those are the nine-step promises. Every step have promises, and most of them are before, Bill was kind, most of them, the promises are before he tells us what we got to do to get it, right? So I began to build my evidence, as it were, that yes, there is something out there bigger than me. Now, I am not a fan of somebody wanting to it be a doorknob or a mailbox. When I'm in the depths of hell, when I'm in the foxhole, when I'm having so much pain that I don't know what to do, I'm not calling out to doorknob. I'm not calling up a mailbox. I may not have a name for it, but I'm calling to it. Now, it does not matter to me if you may be a disciple of Jesus. You may be a follower of Buddha's teachings. You may be Catholic. You may pray the Rosary to Mary. And I will share with you, I have had different experiences in my journey. I have rosary beads. I go to a Catholic adoration chapel every Monday night at 9 p.m. and I sit there for an hour with my friend because it's her job to be there in that adoration chapel at that time. I have had significant spiritual experiences in that chapel. I have had significant spiritual experiences in churches. You know, whatever your thing is, I've got one sponsee, she calls it Sparky. Whatever that is for you, call it. Give it a name. Start working on that relationship. You know, looking back, what I realize is my relationship with my sponsor was a good indication of what my relationship with my higher power is looking like today. And I will tell you, you know, long-term sobriety can be deceiving. That self-reliance and self-sufficiency slips in before we even know it, with the, I got this. I should know better. I'm okay. I can do this. Me. I have to watch out for that kind of stuff because I haven't invited God in. I had to learn that God is a gentleman. He's not going to just reach down and snatch something out of me. That was my biggest fear with step 6 and 7. You know, all those survival instincts that I had that my sponsor called character defects, I was really afraid of 6 and 7. I didn't mind 4 and 5. I love talking about me. Just sit down. We'll talk. I'll start talking about me. 6 and 7 is what terrified me because I literally thought that God was just going to yank me up out of my skin and my skin was going to hit the floor. That is literally what I felt like was going to happen. But that's not what happens. I had to learn, you know, I do my best to use that third step prayer every day, several times a day in my life. I'll give you an example. Anytime there's a person, place, situation, or thing that I am disturbed about, I have learned to put it in the third step prayer. God, I offer my mama to thee. To build with her and do with her as I will. Relieve her of the bondage of self that she may better do thy will. Take away her difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those that she would help of thy love, thy power, and thy way of life. God, I offer my husband's job situation to thee. Build with it and do with it as thy will. God, I offer our insurance to thee. Oh, I need to give y'all the upside to that. So last week he got a huge $30,000 raise and we have insurance. So. Nobody got hurt. I didn't hurt anybody. But those prayers are in there for a reason. I want to skip ahead a little bit. I feel like Spirit's moving me. You've heard me say a lot of different names for God. Power, greater than myself, God of my experience, whatever you want to call it. A few years ago, I do a lot of outside meditations. I love being in nature. I had a spiritual experience when I got here the other day, and Spirit led me straight out to the Etowah Indian Mounds. Oh, my God, I'll tell you about that in a minute. But a few years ago, I was walking on the beach, and some people had been trying to, how do you politely say it? Impress their theological beliefs on me. Okay? And I was struggling with that. I was struggling with that because just because I may believe a certain way doesn't necessarily mean that you have to believe that way, right? And so I was working with a young lady who was really struggling, and so I had really been praying about, God, I need you to help me with this. And so he brought to my mind in the big book where it talks about as we understand God. So I thought about it for a minute, and I was like, but I'm never going to understand God. I'm never going to understand all that power is. I'm never going to understand the omnipresence, the all that is. My human brain cannot handle that. Well, why would I want to put God in a box anyway? Why would I want to box my higher power in to where he fits in a box where I can understand him? And God gave me the words, God of my experience. And it began to show me different experiences that I had had. Some were with people. Some were in that Catholic Adoration Chapel. Some were when I spoke in Maine, a significant event that happened there. And so God began to show me the evidence of when that power had been there and when I had experienced that power, and that those experiences cannot be taken away from me. So I no longer have to have a theological discussion with you because that is the God of your experience and I have the God of my experience. And does it really matter if you call yours Jesus or I call mine Buddha or I call mine Sparky or you do so, you know, that doesn't matter. To me, in my opinion, it's about that, just having the relationship with that. What does that relationship look like? Well, I don't know what that relationship with you looks like, but me, it is an adventure every day. Every day I get up in the morning, I say, God, first I thank you for waking me up, right? I thank you for waking me up, for giving me another day to love and to be of service to him, because when I did that third step prayer, well, the way I understood that was I was making a deal. I was making a deal with God that I was going to do the rest of that program. And from that moment on, I asked God, I said, God, wherever you lead, I'll go. Let me be your feet. Just let me be a servant for you to share people how the steps of AA and the traditions and this program and my sponsor has transformed me in the woman of dignity and grace that you would be. Wherever you lead, I'll go, Father. Just lead me, lead me, lead me. So that's how I start my morning. God, what are you up to today and how can I be a part of it? Now, I will tell you, I'm a mother, I'm a wife, I'm busy in my community, I'm active in my community, and I always have a to-do list. But what I do is when my prayer and meditation time, I sit down and I pray over that list and I ask God and offer that list to God and say, God, whatever you see to fit to get done on this list today, that's what we'll do. Now, I will tell you, prayer and meditation in the beginning of my recovery scared me to death. I literally thought you had to sit in the lotus position with your hands like this going on. I was raised Southern Baptist. That is the furthest thing from my mind, right? So that's why my sponsor's goal was to just get me praying, you know. But I began, what I know today is that I've always been a seeker. And the old timers in that group that time, there was a table in the back of the room, and when an old timer would get through with the book, they would throw the book back there on that table, and we could go get that book. I will tell you, I was raised on the 12 and 12, the big book and the little black book 24 hours a day. And that little black book 24 hours a day has a lot of the four absolutes in there. And that little black book helped me get a power that I could pray to and help me in that relationship more than any other little book. And anybody in my lineage and anybody that I love, I give them that little black book. So that started. Well, they started laying books back there on the table. A lot of the old-timers used to read a lot of Norman Vincent Peale and Dale Carnegie, Don't Worry, Be Happy, a lot of that. The Little Yellow Book, Living Sober. And there may be a twinge in you right now that I am mentioning books that may not be conference approved. Well, first, talk to your sponsor. But second, let me share with you, a lot of the books that the first 100 read are not conference approved. All conference approved means that GSO gets a piece of the profit of the sale of that book. That is all that means. That's all that means. I went and spoke. I'm not even going to tell you the state that I was in. But there was one lady that was a central sponsor for probably about 50 women in that group that I spoke at. And she was, "We only read Congress approved and what the first 100 read." Boy, did I burst her bubble. I mean, the Bible wasn't even Congress approved, and they read that. I mean, come on, people, really? I have to be open. I don't know how the God of my experience is going to speak to me. Sometimes it's through TV. Sometimes it may be through a praise and worship song on the radio. Sometimes it may be through a regular song. Look what happened at a Yes concert the other night. I mean, you know. You just never know. Sometimes it's out of the mouths of that person sitting next to you. Sometimes it's out of the mouths of the person in the meeting. I believe in angels with skin on. And I know the God that I believe in can use you to say something to me that you don't even know you're saying, but you're confirming something that just happened to me in prayer and meditation that morning. So my prayer and meditation started out doing those few minutes, doing those 5 minutes. I got a mentor later down the road, and I just loved him. And he would say, "Amanda," he said, "open, just pray and open your book. And just pick a line out of the book. And just spend about 10 or 15 minutes thinking about that line. And how could you apply that to your life?" Boy, was that a game changer. That made me love the book even more. Because I don't know about y'all, but a lot of times I'll open the book and I'm like, "When did they put that in there?" Because all of a sudden it's jumping out at me. You know, maybe you like Joyce Myers. Maybe you like Marianne Williamson. You know, I am open to whatever God wants to bring to me to help me see. Now, I will tell you, lately it's been a lot about Native American for me. I have Native American ancestry. I have had lots of experiences lately toward that. Lots of experiences in nature. Lord, I am going to share it. Okay, so I will share with you a little bit about what happened at the Etowah Indian Mounds. I argued with God about some of this morning. Yeah, you see I'm not winning. So I didn't want to talk about Annabelle either, but I did. So when I came into town the other day, this is a lot how my life will go today. Once I've said thank you and I ask God, "What are you up to and how can I be a part of it?" I do light my candle. I'm still. Which is really hard for someone like me. But I had to learn. Started out just 5 minutes at a time. Now I'm up to about 2 hours, if I have that time, so that I can hear. Because if my mouth is running, I cannot listen. My sponsor told me that, right? Goes back to that relationship. So I try to hear. So I'm praying and I'm thinking and I'm doing all that stuff and I've prayed over my to-do list and then I'm in the car and I'm asking Spirit to come on, and I don't know about you, but God used to be way out there in the Milky Way for me. Well, He's not way out there in the Milky Way anymore. Right here. I am surrounded. I am surrounded by the light of the Holy Spirit, angel wings, whatever you want to call it. All of that is right here with me. And I go about my day. Sometimes I feel led to stop at a stop sign. I was like, "Well, Lord, do you want me to turn right or left?" That's kind of what happened to me the other day. I'm going through town, and the hotel was to the left, and I'm like, "I'm not supposed to go there yet." So I kept going, and there was a brown sign that said Etowah Indian Mounds. Oh, I know where I'm going. So I fixed my GPS. I'm going out there, and just absolutely beautiful. I had some things to take out there with me, and I started walking out there, and I'm praying, and I'm thanking Spirit, and I'm thanking Creator, and the ancestors, and just for this journey, and I'm walking through the mounds, and no, I'm not supposed to walk up that one. The birds are flying over here, and I'm led down to the water, and I'm by the water. And lately for me, especially since June 14th, well, really the last 5 years, but especially June 14th, feathers come to me. Now, since my sponsor died 2 years ago, I have found a feather every week since she has passed. The day that she passed, one literally dropped out of the sky, out of the blue sky, and fell right at my feet. So feathers have special meaning for me. And I have recently had a relationship with hawks. It's a lot of special meaning for me. I've got two right now in my backyard that we're helping raise. I don't really know how to describe that, except you have to ask me later. So I'm feeling like there's something I'm supposed to see, right? So I will literally say, Spirit, whatever it is I'm supposed to see, don't let me miss it. Angel, direct my eyes. God, I know you're here. Lead me where you would have me going. And so I kind of start walking and I look down and there's the first feather. Thank you. Thank you, Father. So I walk on around and I had been, my hawks are growing up, and so I still see them every morning, every evening, but we're not really getting to have the interaction that we had when they were little. Like literally I feed them. So I was thinking, you know, I said, God, it'd be really nice if I could see a hawk today, right? So I'm walking and one jumps off the fence and about hits my head, scares me to death, and lands two trees down. Well, when he did that, he dropped a feather right at my feet. So then I take another step and there's a tail feather, which are very rare. You don't find a lot of tail feathers. So I'm thanking Creator and I'm thanking Spirit and I'm walking and I'm looking and here's another one. And some of these are so tiny, y'all. I mean, I don't even know how I saw it. It had to be something bigger than me. And so I'm walking again and not a few trees down. It comes at me again off the fence, off that tree, almost leading into me, go huge red-shouldered hawk. And so by the time it was all done right there, I had found 7 hawk feathers. Still don't know what that first feather was. So now I'm feeling all grateful and I'm thinking, okay, that's it. And so I'm, you know, but I'm still just trying to go with Spirit and see what it has me. And there's a blue jay feather. And so then I said, well, you know, I've never found a crow feather. About 10 steps, there's a crow feather. Now, I have all these. They are in my room. I'm not making any of this up. I have shown it to my sponsee. And I don't know why I'm supposed to share that with y'all, but I'm supposed to share that with y'all. And maybe one of the reasons is because we never know where the messages are going to come. You never know where the love's going to come. I will tell you, I found out that a friend of mine this weekend is a beautiful artist. Beautiful artist. And she was kind enough to take us to her home and I could just feel that light and love in that home and I knew which painting I wanted as soon as I saw it. It was on the mantle and it was in a beautiful frame and I knew that was it. But she wanted us to see all these others. So we're going around and we're going around and I've got my hands like this and I'm praying like, I know that's it. I know that's it right there. That's mine. So we come back and I get that painting. Well, then she takes it down because the frame is not attached to the painting. And she says, we need to bind it. Now, I want you to think about that word bind. Bind. When you bind somebody up, when you bind something up, it can't move. It can't be released. It can't be free. I'm like, no, no. So I'm praying about whether or not to say anything about, I don't want her to bind that up. Because I'm trying not to hurt her feelings because I'm buying her artwork. You know, all of that going on at the same time. Well, about that time, the frame fell off the painting. There's my answer. God took care of it right there. Right there. Now, somebody may be thinking that God can't be in the trivial details, but see what I know? God is in the trivial details. If I will invite it in, if I will ask it to lead me, guide me, direct me, show me, lead me, guide me, direct me, show me. When I'm taking my steps, that's what I'm doing. I will tell you that when I pray and meditate today, I've got the candle in front of me. I'm sitting in the lotus position, and I'm going, Om. So it's been kind of a full circle moment. A full circle moment. I feel like I'm supposed to close. Let me just double check and be sure. God had me write a few things down this morning. You know, there's just not enough time to share with you all of the experiences. Outliving 2 of my sponsors and the mentor. Having to go through the death of my grandmother, which was probably one of the hardest things I've ever had to do in sobriety. And it's been 9 years, and I can still feel it. I'm still learning how to handle the emotion, how to deal with emotion. And I'm getting another opportunity to deal with it this year with my daughter being a senior. So I don't know what experiences I'll have out of that, but I'm a willing servant, and maybe I'll be able to help somebody else down the road with it. I'm a rape survivor. I didn't get to share about that. I have a wonderful earth husband who's been with me since my 1 year of sobriety. We've been together 27 years. We've been married 20 in December 11th. He's never seen me drink. Doesn't have any issues. No alcoholism in his family. I tried to get rid of him. He came back. Just a wonderful light in my life. I have my beautiful daughter. She's 17. She's a senior in high school. My handsome son is 15. He just got his permit. And that is a real spiritual activity, trying to be with him when he's driving. I'm over here with claw marks on the dashboard while he's driving, right? They've never seen their mother take a drink. They know about alcoholism. They know my whole story. We've had that whole conversation, and so far they're making good decisions. They're their own people. They're their own children of God. And what I had to realize is they no longer fit in my hula hoop. You know, when they were little, what's in my hula hoop is my business, right? A hula hoop. You know, a hula hoop. So when you set a hula hoop, I want y'all to go to Dollar Tree and get your hula hoop and set it down on the ground. Now, I don't know about you. Don't be buying some gigantic special one now. Get your regular hula hoop. Nothing else fits in there. Now, right now, my little puppy fits in there with me, but she's growing up too. She'll be a year in October. But my children don't fit in there with me anymore. They don't fit in there with me anymore. And I'm getting opportunities every day to peel another layer of my onion. See, I'm like a big old Vidalia onion. When you go to the grocery store, that when you get it home, that first brown crusty layer, that comes off pretty easy. That was my first time going through the steps. That second layer comes off, you know, you can tear it with your finger. It's not that hard. That was my second time going through the steps. And every time I go through the steps, it's like pulling another layer of that onion. I go through the steps about every 18 months to 2 years. And I'm peeling another layer of my onion. Well, Amanda, why are you trying to peel the layers of your onion? Because I'm trying to get to the core. I'm trying to get to the middle, because that's the woman of dignity and grace that I believe the God of my experience would have me be. Now, I will tell you, I'm in some of the layers now where I've had to get enough. And it's not easy. And sometimes it's painful. But today I'm still willing to peel another layer of that onion, because I'm continue to seek. This tells us, continued for a lifetime. This is a lifelong process. I keep wanting to get to that middle, to the woman of the dignity of grace that God would have me be. Now, I will tell you, there was some earthly struggle between me and my higher power this morning about how I wanted to close this morning. This is my favorite pamphlet. It's called A Member's Eye View. I don't know if any of y'all ever heard Judge Jack, but Judge Jack from Hagerstown, Maryland, used to close with this every time he taught, and he was a very dear friend of mine. Well, yesterday when we were over at the Sir Club, I'm always going to see what y'all got, and y'all have my favorite pamphlet. So I got one, and I gave it to Toby. And I was struggling this morning about, God, how do you want me to close this morning? What would you have me say? And at the last minute, I asked Toby, did she have it? And she said, yes. So if you will indulge me, I will close with the end of this pamphlet. This is an alcoholic talking to non-alcoholics. And we heard this weekend, Amazing Grace, and breaking the chains, and being able to be free, and be happy, joyous, and free, and the miracles in this program. This coming Sunday, in the churches of many of us, there will be read that portion of the Gospel of Matthew, which recounts the time when John the Baptist was languishing in the prison of Herod. And hearing the works of his cousin Jesus, he sent two of his disciples to say to him, Art thou he who is to come, or shall we look for another? And Christ did as he so often did. He did not answer them directly, but wanted John to decide for himself. And so he said to the disciples, Go and report to John what you have heard and what you have seen. The blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, the poor have the gospel preached to them. Back in my childhood catechism days, I was taught that the poor in this instance did not mean only the poor in a material sense, but also meant the poor in spirit. those who burned with an inner hunger and an inner thirst, and that the word gospel meant quite literally the good news. More than 16 years ago, four men, my boss, my physician, my pastor, and the one friend I had left, working singly and together, maneuvered me into AA. Today, if they were to ask me, "Tell us, what did you find?" I would say to them what I now say to you. I can tell you only what I have heard and seen. It seems the blind do see, the lame do walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead rise, and over again, in the middle of the longest day or the darkest night, the poor in spirit have the good news told to them. God grant that it may always be so. My name is Amanda Brown. I'm a happy alcoholic. Thank you for letting me share. Thank you. I have asked Toby.